Radio. This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Yes, everybody, you know the drill. We started this podcast to help anyone who's remotely interested in trapping and neutering animals. We're the help we didn't receive when we first wanted to get involved, and we want to be your new friends in the TNR world. I'm Adele, one of your hosts for today, and I am very excited to introduce to you Angeline. Angeline is from the Humane Society of Southern Arizona, where her role as the life-saving outcomes manager, very cool title, she leads transformative programs that improve shelter outcomes and support pet retention in the community. She has pioneered HSSA's first community cat program, which offers free volunteer trapping assistance and judgment-free trap neuter return services to over 3,000 community cats annually in the city of Tucson, in local prisons and rural communities across Southern Arizona. You can still find her sometimes in the field trapping and rescuing cats, but her primary focus now incorporates streamlining shelter operations to help animals find placement more efficiently by reducing barriers and implementing inclusive approaches that bridge the gap between human and animal welfare and keep animals in their communities. Welcome, Angeline. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you, Adele. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So we like to generally start our conversation with a question, and that is, when did you first start thinking about animal rights or animal rescue?
You know, that's kind of a hard question for me, because I think it's been happening since I was a little girl. I find drawings of mine from when I was five with cats on them. But my first real memory is of realizing, just like knowing about animal rights and wanting to be involved was when I was a young kid. My mom grew up in the Alps of France and in a really small village. And there were a lot of free roaming cats, and the ways that they would handle the population at the time when I was a kid was really not humane. And so I realized that there was an issue, I guess you could say, with cat population from a young age, but I didn't quite realize what that entailed. And when I was in sixth grade, I became really attached to some cats that lived under a trailer pod in my elementary school and would get into fights with our principal over the care of the cats, because I was really, really attached to them and wanting to feed them and care for them. And then just throughout the years, learning more about animal rights and veganism, vegetarianism, all of that, it just really fueled my passion to want to be in this field and want to keep continuing helping animals.
That's awesome. So it's always been cats from a young age. That's really cool. I think one thing that's really interesting about speaking with you today is you are our first guest from the United States. All of our episodes up until now have been all different parts of the world, cities in Mexico, cities in India, the Philippines. And that's partly what we want to do. We want to bring an international perspective of community cat care from all over the world. But what a lot of people don't realize is what you just pointed out is even in the global north, the United States, France, the UK, there are still a lot of issues that community cats and free roaming animals face. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today. Okay, so how long have you been overseeing this program at the Humane Society?
I started as a cat trapper about 4 years and 10 months ago, brand new out of, I came from a wildlife education background. So I was working at a wildlife hospital when this opportunity arrived. So I became a cat trapper, but I didn't start overseeing the program until about 10 months or so after I joined. When the previous person who had been overseeing the program departed. And it left an opportunity for someone to take over the program and do something new with it. At the time when I started, we were just trapping haphazardly. We would take calls and then just put them on our schedule and just go left and right and nonstop trap with no direction and no plan. And so when I took over the program, I really wanted to strategize and figure out how to bring more people into it and figure out how to make the program more sustainable.
That's awesome. That's a really important part that we're going to talk about today. And that brings up an interesting point. Like, the fact that you were a full-time paid trapper is pretty unique. These full-time neutering programs are pretty rare already. I've been doing one in Athens in Greece for the last year. And I myself also, after some time, wanted to leave the field and do something from a project management perspective because it's really tiring, right? So yes, can you tell us a little bit about that? Like, what was it like
Absolutely.
Having full-time staff? And I think now you've changed strategy a little bit, right? And you have volunteers on staff.
Over the years, I've had to change the strategy based on resources, but also based on my own like mental and physical exhaustion. Because when I was just the trapper, I was brand new to trapping cats. I had been doing wildlife rescue and rehab before. And so it was just brand new to me. And I didn't feel like I had the right support to do it like 4 or 5 days a week, just constantly going out and trapping. So not only was I trapping all of the cats, I was scheduling all of the calls, and I was returning all of the cats, cleaning all of the equipment. So all of that was very overwhelming. So I started to realize that my physical health was declining, my mental health was declining, and that made me realize that something really needed to change, especially when my coworker left. It was just on me. So I thought about ways of how I could make the program more sustainable, not just for me, but to keep this program alive for a long time. And I decided I needed more people. I needed more people to be involved. And I started looking into the community to see who was already doing the work and started to build connections with those people and offer my help for them. And I slowly started to build a volunteer program by inviting people who were just interested in the project, who had expressed some type of interest or desire to help, to come join me for a night with no strings attached. Just come out in the field and I'll show you what it's like, and let's do it together. And from there, I was able to build a community. And now we have quite a lot of volunteers, which feels amazing.
That's really interesting. You've highlighted a lot of really important stuff there. It is mentally and physically exhausting. I can't believe you were alone at one point, because it includes so much, right? I've had so many people come to me and say, oh my God, dream job, full-time trapper. And I felt the same at the start. I literally moved to Greece so that I could do this full time, but it's exhausting. There is so much to do constantly. And then there's calls afterwards to schedule things for the next day. There's, you know, community members calling your work phone. There's always something to do. You're dreaming of cats. You're thinking about the colonies that you want to revisit. It's so much. So that seems like a really strategic choice to move towards more volunteers, and also very smartly brings the community in more, which is kind of essential for any social program, right? Whether it's for humans or animals, it's making it community-based rather than like being the one to be called to the scene to help, right?
Absolutely. It's community-based and we reach more people and we can do better follow-ups. We can have better conversations. We can take breaks. So we really encourage our volunteers to take a lot of breaks. If we start noticing someone's not doing well or not feeling well, we encourage that break. We sometimes will implement it for them, just to make sure that people are, they're recognizing when they need.
That's awesome. Do you want to share a little bit about how you got volunteers on board, how you got people engaged and also trained on the standards of work that you wanted to uphold?
Yes. My big thing with volunteers is I really wanted to set a culture and a standard for volunteers working in TNR, because as you know, we're working with community members who may have been dismissed by other people or organizations in Tucson, especially. There's a lot of animosity and misunderstanding of community cats. And a lot of people move to Tucson for the sunshine and they don't realize we have quite a lot of cats, a big population of outdoor cats. And they can often get very frustrated moving into a home or into a mobile home park and realizing that there are cats running around.
Yeah, volunteers, how to get people engaged.
So when I first started reaching out for volunteers, I started talking to people who are already doing the work and I offered my services. I said, hey, if you want to trap, I know that's the more exciting part of TNR is trapping, I will do all the transport. I'll bring them to the clinic. I will clean the equipment and I'll do all of that heavy work for you. And so I got a couple of interested trappers that way. One with a really big social media platform, Courtney Gustafson, who is from Poet Square Cats. And so she also got excited about it and started inviting people out. But I called it Cat Trapping Thursdays, where every single Thursday I was out in the field, no matter what. It's always sunshine here, so we don't have to worry too much about the weather. So every Thursday I was out and I was available for volunteers or for anyone to come and join me to learn about TNR and to do it with me. So I would go over a briefing with them. I always sent them our standards of conduct, how they're supposed to be acting in the field, how they should approach situations, and they would shadow me in the field. And I started it that way to kind of reduce barriers for volunteers to join. And I feel like that has been a really successful way to get people interested in the work.
That's a really cool idea and enables you to also still be in the field sometimes doing what you originally piqued your interest about this, which is trapping. Yeah, like bringing people in and trapping together and showing them perhaps is not as difficult as they think. We hear that a lot. People are like, oh, it's too hard. Like even setting up the trap in my yard, I'm afraid, I don't know what to do, but you show them how to do it. And you also make sure they're doing it considerately. That's really cool.
We have fun with it too. So I'd bring bingo. So I'll create bingo cards like I trapped an orange cat or trapped a cat using a drop trap or got yelled at by the neighbor. You know, like kind of make fun. So when volunteers come out, they can do bingo and I'd have a fun little prize for them at the end of the day. So I just try to switch it up and just make it more exciting for people. And also like if they wanted to come and check it out and if it wasn't their thing, no hard feelings. Maybe fostering's more your jam. So we just made it open to people to come check it out. No commitments. You can come check it out, sign a little waiver. And then if you do like it, sign on to do more with our program.
That's awesome. That's a really fun idea. What are some other ways that volunteers get involved? So you talked about fostering. Do they also help with like overnighting cats after the surgery? Obviously being feeders, but are there any other roles like transportation that they can volunteer to do?
Our volunteers, we have a wonderful group. They help with our food distribution program. So we provide food for community cat caregivers. So the volunteers who don't have the physical ability to be out in the field now help with that program. They'll pack the food and distribute it. We also have volunteers help with equipment cleaning or maintenance. We have specific volunteers who love to fix traps, which is amazing. We have other volunteers who love to transport. So they might help transport to and from colony sites. They'll do follow-ups with caregivers. A lot of our volunteers will build those personal relationships with caregivers, which helps with those follow-ups. So they kind of help with the flow of the organization and help onboard new volunteers and train. So they really are like the heart of this program.
Cool. Really cool. It sounds like there's something for everybody to do.
Yeah, we will find something. That's the part of reducing the barriers. Is if you want to help us, if you want to come take photos, come take photos, come take a video. So anything that people want to contribute, we'll find a way to make it work, usually.
Cool. And you mentioned it before, how heavy this work can be physically and mentally. People who are out in the field, they see difficult things with the cats. They see difficult situations with humans. There's people who are disenfranchised trying to help cats. There are hoarding situations. There's cruelty situations. There's a lot to deal with. So do you have any tips or advice on how to maintain team well-being or volunteer well-being to make sure everybody is doing well and it's sustainably running?
Yeah, my biggest tip, I think, would be build a community. Your program or your trapping group will be much stronger if you feel like there's a sense of community and friendship. So part of while I was doing those Cat Trapping Thursdays, I was also once a month or so would have once a month, I would have these meetings where people can come together, and we still have them, come together and discuss trapping sites, challenges that they're having, and help build that community. And we'd also do hangouts, go hang out at a cat cafe or something similar, go out to dinner, just ways where we can connect. And we also do a lot of debriefing and training. So we'll debrief if a situation is extremely challenging or there was a really aggressive neighbors. We might talk about it and have like a group meeting and really talk about what happened and how we can move forward and how we can continue to help, or if we should maybe not continue to help. And then we definitely prioritize mental health. So I'm always saying, hey, like, there are services out there. There's therapy. You can go to counseling. We have resource books on our bookshelf. We talk about it every month in our meeting about taking breaks. So we really try to show by example too. So we try, if I see one of my staff members is not doing well, I'll tell them they need to take a break. So we look out for each other too. And we're honest about how we're doing. A lot of us have also physical challenges. So we try to set boundaries too and make sure that everyone's taking care of themselves.
It's cool that you pay attention to this stuff. And really, it's an investment in the future of the project, but also the future of the people working on the project, which is an essential part. We all know how difficult animal rescue is, and that, you know, the average career expectancy in animal rescue is like 3 years. Like, it's really short. Veterinarians have it hard. Everybody has it hard. So it's really cool that you take such effort to make everybody feel supported and look out for each other. You mentioned something there about debriefs about situations like with specific difficult issues. So are there any like specific tools you use to look out for safeguarding concerns or mitigate safeguarding concerns? Like, do you use a buddy system when people go out in the field? Do you have any specific training around like de-escalation of situations or conflict management?
Yeah. So now that we have grown a lot as a program, we do trainings before we invite, like, we will invite people out to the field if they want to check it out. But if they want to become like a full-fledged volunteer, they need to go through our training process. And so it's about an hour and a half, where we talk about all of, sometimes a little longer, sometimes where we talk about all of these things, de-escalation, how to approach certain scenarios in the field. We'll do, what's it called? Role playing sometimes too, where we had one of our team members set up what looked like a hallway with different doors where you knock on the doors and talk about different cat scenarios with people. And we do go over de-escalation and what to do and what to say in certain situations and how to act, and how if you're starting to feel emotional and you start to feel those emotions rise and your anger rise, that maybe you need to take a step back and let your buddy take over the conversation. We do have a buddy system for areas of town if we're expecting to move between houses. We do canvassing before we go out trapping, which is for especially larger colonies, which helps keep people safe because we can look to see what's going on in the neighborhood. We look out for loose dogs, for people, you know, just different things that might cause a concern when we're out in the field trapping. And we don't knock on doors after dark anymore. Arizona is a very gun happy state. And so we have had a couple instances of just knocking on someone's door to ask about cats and a gun being pulled in our face.
Oh God.
So we have to be very careful with violence and gun violence in Arizona. So we do look out. So we watch our six. A lot of the training has to do with, like, you're in the field. What are you paying attention to? It's not just the cat. It's not just the trap. You're paying attention to your surroundings. You're talking to the caregiver. You're talking to people whose property you're on. We never trespass. We wear safety vests, which are kind of, you know, they're cute. They're purple, big safety vests, and that's for at night in the field for cars that go by. We have to be careful because we've had people, like, cars swerve at cats and at our trappers. So we really need to be attentive to our surroundings when we're trapping.
Yeah, and I think I've seen you have the Humane Society branding on the purple vests, right? So people can see you're not just like workers out, but you're from a community cat program. Have you found that when you identify yourselves to the public, when you are out canvassing or trapping, and then being able to see you are from this specific program? I mean, Humane Society is quite a recognizable brand and name, right? Has that made people more receptive to you, or has it perhaps made some difficulties where they're like, oh no, the trappers are back, I'm bringing my cats inside because I don't want them to be neutered?
Absolutely. And I think it's a bit of both. It depends on the community that you're working in. So there are definitely situations where those vests are extremely helpful. So we work in a lot of mobile home parks. And when we have those vests on in those parks, people tend to be like, oh, it's a group. They're coming. They're helping about the cats. Because it does say on our back, like, Humane Society Cat Trapper. We have a cat on the front. If we're in a community that's opposing, or we think, or is kind of giving us looks and a little concerned about our presence, we actually have flashing cat ears that we will wear, because we're not going to be too scary if we're wearing cat ears. So we kind of do things like that. And we always say hi, we wave, we come into their community as a guest. We're not in, we want to feel, we don't want to come in and be an opposing force or make people do anything. We want to just offer help and inform people. So people do think that we're animal control or anything like that. We can just tell them we're not. It helps that a lot of our group are volunteers, because they'll see, oh, it's another community member helping me. But then there are other neighborhoods where we choose to not wear our vests. If we're working in a neighborhood that's more underserved, we will choose not to in some instances, as long as it's safe, just so that people are not nervous about our presence and that they're more willing to talk to us and work with us.
I mean, that's a lot of like really practical stuff that people can incorporate. I'd love to see more people wearing flashing cat ears out in the field. That would be amazing. Yeah. And I mean, we're always nervous about that in Greece, especially in rural areas. Like a lot of people have quite strong feelings against neutering. And so there's always this debate back and forth. Should we identify ourselves? Should we say this program is going to be happening before we come into the area? Or should we try to be a bit more discreet so that we can like demonstrate that, yes, we're trapping cats, but we're bringing them back. And so there's not this fear before. But you've illustrated a lot of good points about why identifying ourselves can be beneficial. And one being, you bring the community into the project, right? Like you're providing services to the community as well, not just the cats.
Yeah. And that's what's important, really important to me too, is that consent from the community and their involvement in it. I want them, especially caregivers who are feeding, to be a part of the solution, because once they get involved, they're more likely to keep up with the colony management in a positive way if they're a part of that solution. I do think identifying ourselves even to the cat haters, you know, like people who really don't want us to be there, is beneficial, because we can have conversations. We can ask them why do they not think neutering will help solve the problem, or what are their concerns? And a lot of times just venting and talking to us, or us being able to provide humane deterrence, or informing them that if you spay neuter, you know, the population will decrease, and if there are vaccines on board, the cats will be healthier. All of that has gone a long way with us to help with that conflict resolution between neighbors.
Cool. Awesome. Well, we're going to take a very quick break, and then we're going to be back to talk a little bit more.
You know the expression, cats have nine lives. Well, what if you can give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying or neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations, too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Okay, we are back with Angeline, and we are going to talk a little bit more now about the strategic side of the neutering program. So my first question is, what are the services that you're offering? Are you offering just neutering? Are you also vaccinating, parasite treatment, like medical care if they need it?
Absolutely, yeah. So we're very fortunate to have a lot of services offered for free for community cats. There are two clinics in town that provide free TNR services. The clinic at the Humane Society provides the spay-neuter, ear tip, vaccines, the FVRCP, rabies, and flea and tick prevention. If the cat does need more medical needs, like if they have parasites, we could do dewormer. We can do injectable antibiotics if they have an upper respiratory infection, which we see a lot of. And if they do need additional medical care than that, we can work with our vets to maybe figure out a plan if the cats are handleable, or kind of make decisions based on how the cat's temperament is, if there are resources in town, other programs. We often work with smaller rescues that might be able to help and fundraise for those cats with special needs. We even have a couple of cats that are now Instagram famous from being rescued from our TNR program. Like Shrek from Shrek in the City was one that we trapped, and we were able to partner with a local rescue to get him the medical care he needed. And then now he lives in New York as a fancy cat.
Awesome.
So, it all just depends. And yeah, so we work with the veterinarians to really decide the outcome of cats with more severe medical injuries or illness.
That's really cool that you provide basically everything that they need. I think a lot of programs that we talk to, especially in the Global South, there's a huge resource restriction, which means a lot of people aren't doing vaccines. Like I haven't vaccinated a lot of the cats I've neutered on my own because it comes down to having the access to money, having the access to affordable vet care, vets who want to do that. Like some vets are hesitant to do a vaccine and a sterilization at the same time. So that's really cool that you're able to do that. One thing I've seen about consistently about the United States is the wildly expensive cost of vet care. So like, how do you navigate this side of things when they need extra stuff? Do the vets offer lower cost stuff? Do you have to do special fundraising projects for individual cats?
Yeah. We often have to do special fundraising projects, and we're not able to give like full medical care to every cat. So we have a lot of cats with dental disease that we're not going to be able to help. And, you know, sometimes we have to make a tough call of euthanasia rather than treat, depending on how severe the condition is. But we do special fundraising. It really helps to have an amazing trapper. She's one of our regular trappers and leaders, Courtney from Poet Square Cats. If we do have a cat that's in big need, she might post a fundraiser to help fundraise for that care, which is really incredible. So and then our vets will sometimes prescribe, if the cats are handleable, they can prescribe medicine for free, and we take it out of our fund, so through our yearly fundraising. So it's all just depends on the situation and what resources we do have and what the cat's temperament level is and how attached they are or how attached their caregiver is to them also. Because we do recognize that community cats mean so much to these caregivers, just as much as an owned pet. So we want to really respect that too.
I love that. That's a really nice way of looking at it. Speaking of that, let's talk about intake or situations where caregivers want the cat to be taken in, or they have extra needs and they cannot go back to the street, or maybe you found kittens in the field or people are asking to bring you kittens. How do you manage to focus on TNR and make sure that the project is really sustainable and population management focused?
Yeah. That can get really challenging, especially with newer volunteers who aren't used to bringing back kittens in the field. This is where we try to rope in the caregiver into the solution. If they really want kittens to be intaked, if they really want them to be taken in, we will encourage them to start socializing them themselves and be a part of that solution. We let them know we have limited fosters. We have limited services available. We'll support you in the field. So if we find kittens in the field, we might support them with food, with bowls, with a shelter. And we keep track on what we call our we have like a kitten chart. So we track their ages and where they're about to be. And we'll follow up with that caregiver and provide support of different rescues they can go to if they really want to do an intake for, if the cats are social. Otherwise, we just talk about that it's okay that the cats live outside and that they grow up outside in their colony. So if they really don't have the resources to take them in and try socializing them, we just let them know that's all right. They're not really doing a disservice to those cats. They're doing the best thing that they can for them, which is to get them spayed and neutered, vaccinated, you know, because we have that ability, and to just continue caring for them. For colony caregivers that are extremely overwhelmed, because we do work with colonies of sometimes 50, 60 more. One mobile home park, we have around 500. We've been working on it for several months now. We're at like 250 cats spay neutered for that mobile home park. So through situations like that, or where we know those cats are not going to survive, their outcome is very, very low, those are the cats that we do prioritize and we do intake for. Especially mobile home parks with those large colonies, caregivers are trying everything they can, but they have very limited financial support. That's who we prioritize. And the people with transportation, with funds, we let them know about other rescues, about rehoming, and we kind of support them in that way instead.
Okay, cool. Yeah, this attitude, this belief, this pressure to like get cats off the street and not have them living outside in the community seems really strong in places like the US, in places like the UK. I have noticed when people visit Greece, they're like, oh no, all these cats are on the street. But actually, a lot of the cats that I was talking about are neutered and like cared for. And it is okay.
They're happy.
Yeah. Like it is okay to, you know, if they are safe, like leave kittens on the street with their mother who is taking care of them and then spay her and spay them when they're old enough. It is okay to have community animals. And one thing this ideology has led to is very full shelters. This is a unique feature of America, right? And one reason why it's not like that in the global South is because we don't have shelters to put animals in. So it's led to more focus on spay and neuter.
On community, on keeping them in their communities. And that's something I had to really work on working here. When I started in Community Cats, our shelter was so full of cats that when I did have a cat that needed assistance or a kitten I wanted to intake, I couldn't. There was no space in our shelter at all. I had to work with small rescues to intake pretty much all of the kittens that needed assistance for the first couple of years because of how full. But through this TNR program, we've been able to offer a different service to people and encourage them to continue caring for their cats and just supporting them and caring for their cats. A lot of people just need to hear those words of like, no, you're doing a great job. Like you're doing great. We like especially from the Humane Society or a volunteer who works with cats, that goes a long way because they hear from their neighbors all the time that they should get rid of them. The cats are a problem. So a lot of times just having those conversations of saying, no, you're doing great. You're doing everything you can. And, you know, thank you for caring for these cats. That's one of my biggest things. When people don't want to spay neuter, I say, well, why don't we write them a card and just thank them for caring about the cats, provide a little bit of food and say, if you ever want our help, we're here. And a lot of times that works.
Cool.
It's just being able to build that trust first before you come in and kind of change everything for them.
Yeah. You mentioned this a little bit before about making note of ages of kittens and following up with colonies. Can you talk a little bit about your monitoring process? Like, how do you structure having a schedule and a plan for areas you've started neutering in? How frequently do you go back? And when are you going back to do the kittens and check up on the colony for any intact cats?
Sure. We track the colony in a couple different ways. So we have a call log. So when people call us with requests for help, we track those with the date they called and the situation. And we put like a priority on there if it can, because we do have quite a long wait list for our team to come out and assist. I believe now it was a little longer, but we've gotten it down to, I think, 4 months. So we do sometimes prioritize ones that need help sooner than that. So we have that list and we put them on our schedule for volunteers to sign up for, on Trello. And then once those cats do get altered, we track the number of cats altered, in that Excel and also a separate surgery Excel. And then we put all of this on a map. So we use MapLine, to track it all so we can visually see what work we're doing. And if we need to canvas more in the area, it will show you like the population density so we can see what areas we need to focus more on. And then through monitoring, we have a lot of volunteers who create those personal relationships, especially with the large colonies. So they'll go back and provide food for a couple of months. They'll do check-ins and help get those last remaining stubborn cats. Because we often have like the one or two cats that just we can't trap. But we do phone calls mostly. We call up our caregivers and ask them how it's going, if they have new cats. Just probably not quite as often as I really wish we would.
Well, I mean, 4 months wait time for trapping and neutering services may sound like a long time, but actually that sounds not that long to me, considering you are servicing such a large area and you're like quite a core program there. And I mean, 250 cats in one location, and this trailer park location you mentioned before, this is a huge amount of work. And so yeah, that's actually quite cool. One thing that I have seen a lot of programs do is go just based on scheduling their work based on when the public calls them in, and then immediately running to the scene, trapping, not going back, not finishing the colony. And yes, cats get trapped, but it's not strategic TNR, is it? So that's what you're doing. You're doing strategic TNR to make sure you're getting at least that 80% sterilization, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we try to hit more than 80. We really try to do like 90, 95, but we really try our best. And we'll go multiple nights in a row, which really helps for those large colonies. If you can go night after night after night, like that's really the best way to catch the large amount. But some people's like individual homes will have more than 80 cats.
Wow.
And if they're indoor, outdoor, local animal control does not get involved. So it's really up to our organization or someone else to help these people. So that can take quite a long time and a lot of resources, like 80 cats. That's over a week of surgery spaces that we have available. So that's, we have to really strategically kind of coordinate those sites and maybe do them over a few weeks rather than all at once, depending on what our surgery availability is.
Yeah. And some of those cats are going to be really difficult to trap, especially if you're going back quite a few days. Do you have any tips, like any specific traps or strategies you use to get the remaining difficult ones?
Sure. We do drop trapping a lot, and we use like the normal tomahawk and true catch traps, but we also have like the clear door, which is really helpful. They sell an attachment. It's a clear back door. So for those really tricky cats, sometimes that's the way to get them. But I think for those really tricky cats, you have to work with the caregiver. You need the caregiver's involvement in that and their desire to finish out the colony. Because a lot of times we can't get the last remaining ones because they don't want to stop feeding. They're like, oh, all these cats need to be fed. Like, I can't just stop feeding. So we try to talk to them about their concerns in that way. And yeah, and then hopefully if they're capable, we will train them on how to do the trapping also. So they can maybe set a trap for us and we can do a pickup when they do catch the cat. So different strategies for different people.
When you said you sometimes use the traps with like clear doors on one side, is that because that works because the cats think there's another exit?
Okay. Yes, cool. Exactly. Cool. And we do trap training too. Like, so we might set up a trap and have the caregiver feed within the trap and move the food further down until they can trap it.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because I think trap training is something really normal in the United States, but I don't see a lot of other places do this like trapping preparation with the caregiver. And like you said, like a lot of people are resistant, like, no, I can't do that, or I don't know how, or I don't want to stop feeding them. Like, they'll run across the street looking for food and get hit by a car, like all these things that will prevent them from being involved. But trap training and getting them used to the trap can really be effective at catching the difficult ones, can't it?
Yes, I really think that's how I've caught some of the most difficult cats. Or if it's a female, if they're one of your, if the female just keeps getting pregnant and keeps giving birth, here in Tucson, the female cats can give birth 3 to 4 times during the year because of how hot it is here. So if they have another litter, I'll wait till those kittens grow up a little bit and then use their kittens to trap mom. So putting those kittens in a separate trap and having the trap for mom be near it so that when she can only see her kittens if she goes into her trap. So, but trap training, I think, is only doable if you have the resources and the time also to like start out with trap training. I have seen a lot of groups where they'll bring like 10 traps and for a week start feeding them in the traps. Like our team would not have the equipment or ability to do that type of trap training. So we tend to do trap training when things are already difficult and we need to get those last few cats.
Cool. Well, that's a really helpful strategy for people to use if they're struggling getting the last kittens in their colony. And then the last thing I want to ask you about is you mentioned a few cool resources you use for data tracking. So Trello for project management stuff, yeah?
Yeah, we use Trello for volunteer management, project management. We use MapLine. We might be phasing out of it, but it's an online mapping software where you can upload your Excel and it will map. Just put places on the map for you and you can change the little icons to different things and have different Excel spreadsheets on there, similar to like a Google Maps. So we're looking into something a little different because that can get a little pricey and wonky. So it doesn't really save the data. If you accidentally delete something, it doesn't save it for you. So that's kind of a problem. And then we use a lot of just manual Excel. And we also use Signal. I think something very unique to our group is we have a texting group. And we use an app called Signal where we can create texting groups of trappers. So if we have five trappers working on one specific site, we'll make their own group for them so they can communicate and we can share information with them through that group.
Cool. Awesome. That sounds really useful. Gosh, I mean, this is a lot of really great information that I didn't know and that people can actually incorporate. Thank you so much for sharing. Can you let everybody know where they can find you?
Oh, I'm not really active on like social media or anything like that. Come visit Tucson. I don't know. You could email me if you really want to talk to me more. I would love to hear from you. Also, I'm on LinkedIn. My email is just my first initial A and last name Fahey, Fahey, @hssaz.org.
Cool. And we'll put the Humane Society website in the show notes so anybody can check out that program. Is there anything else you want to share with anybody? Last takeaway, piece of advice, message?
Keep doing the good work. If you feel like you're starting to burn out, please take a break. Find resources. We need you in this field. And I hope more people do set boundaries and learn that they are very valuable to this work and that they stick around and they can find a way to stick around.
Awesome. An important message to end on. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you,
Adele. I really appreciate it. And thank you to everybody else for joining us on this adventure. We're really excited about it and we'd really like to hear about your experience. You can reach out to us on social media, either at Saving Lives with 2 A's or Travel Animal Rescue on Instagram. So see you all at our next episode. And in the meantime, stay out of trouble and keep trapping to save the streets one animal at a time.
Let's Talk Pets every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.